VIP. Let's kick it.
Welcome to TA1. Everything you want to know about everything, and sometimes adventure racing. I'm your host, legendary Randy Erickson, and we're going in a little different direction today. No offense to anybody else, but one of my favorite interviews ever. So it's a long one, so buckle up and enjoy my talk with Dan.
I gotcha. Yeah, you're still muted. There you go.
All right. Got out of it now. Yeah, let me just find a coaster here.
Okay.
All right. Cool. Okay. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. You're inside, I'm outside.
Yeah, I would be outside, but we're having a little thunderstorm right now, so.
Yeah. It's about 90 here in Rapids, so.
Yeah, it's like 89 here. I'm in Western Massachusetts currently.
Yeah.
What do we got? 86. And I got,
running late, so I'm at mom's house. You never get too old to go to mom's house to work or play.
Yeah, right?
So, first of all, tell everybody who you are.
Okay. my name is Dan Shefflin, and I am formerly was living in Spearfish, South Dakota, but now currently in Western Mass, where I'm originally from.
And you are a mountain biker and what's the title?
Ice hole. Antarcticin, person who goes to Antarctica, or the ice, as we call it.
Which fascinates me, and I'm not sure why, because I hate the cold, but and you're also a mountain biker.
Also a mountain biker, yes, for sure. And bike mechanic as well.
Oh, you're a master of a lot of things, so.
Well, a jack of many, maybe not a master of
them. So Western Mass, then how did you get to South Dakota?
Long story.
That's what we like.
Yeah, totally. Well, long story, started in 2010. I was living in Seward, Alaska, but I'd gotten a summer job working in northern Wisconsin. And I was driving my 1989 Volvo station wagon between Alaska and Wisconsin, and I misjudged the amount of time it would take. And I ended up with an extra week or so when I got to the Twin Cities, and was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. So I basically, it was like semi-early Google days, 2010, whatever. Not early, but basically just looked at Google Maps and saw the name Spearfish and was like, that's a crazy name of some place. And it said that it had good biking. And I went there, and it happened to be April, May, must have been May, and it was Bike to Work Week. And there was just a ton of like biking stuff that happened. Just ended up staying for a week, had a great time. And then every year I came back for a week. And then several years after I finished, or I ceased working at this summer job in Wisconsin, I was still going to Antarctica in the winters all this time. I decided I didn't want to go to Wisconsin again. And I was like, maybe I'll spend the whole summer in Spearfish. And one of my friends kindly offered me to stay in their basement. And I got hooked up working at a bike shop and did that for a few years, then bought a house there and had that house for 4 years, 3.5 years or so, and then sold it last month.
Tell me you did well on selling the house.
I did pretty good, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know how you would not, right?
Yep. But I mean, that being said, can't buy one. So
yeah,
it's all sort of relative.
Here in Rapid, to, like,
block this.
Yeah. My mom's neighbors I've been sitting in Rapid, but my mom's neighbors bought the house next door, you know, a ranch, 1,200 square foot ranch, 270 last August, and they're selling it for 330. Nice. And it'll last a week. So.
Yeah, well, it's starting to turn around. I was worried because it took me 13 days to sell my house. The times are changing a little bit, but yeah, I mean, it's still presumably a pretty good market for you over there.
It's really slowing down. When Paulette and I, we bought our house in Sioux Falls, it was on the market for 2 hours.
2 hours?
Two hours.
Must have been nerve-wracking.
A friend of ours, and she kind of said, well, this house is going for sale, you know, technically this afternoon. You want to go look at it? We went and looked at it and said, we'll buy it.
And
then when we sold it, it took her 2 days to sell it. So I was really upset.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's crazy. I never really imagined buying a house and then selling it in relatively short order and the way the market works.
Exactly.
I did for sale by owner, which was kind of a cool experience, and also, at least in South Dakota, was very, very easy. Mm-hmm. like incredibly easy. It was kind of a big leap to be like, I'm just gonna do this myself, DIY selling the house. You just watch some YouTube videos and off you go.
So did you then, like, when you got it, did you actually get a lawyer to look at it when you're ready to go, or did you just figure you had
So, Randy, you're not the only person to ask that question.
Well, that's what everybody says, right? Always get a lawyer to look at it.
So the short answer, no, we did not get a lawyer. The reason was that the sale of my house was very straightforward. There were no contingencies. There were no, there were no contingencies or like weird things. It was just like, you want to buy the house? I want to sell the house. Like, this is how much you're agreeing to pay for it. You can pay for it. Like, you know, there's the formalities of the inspection and the appraisal. I mean, they're not formalities. They're things that have to happen, but you know, you just do it. And then, so if there had been like, I need to get the roof replaced before I sell it or whatever, then probably would have brought a lawyer in. But really, there's a form that's on the South Dakota Department of Labor's website. It's a legal form, the purchase agreement for the house. And it's like 6 pages. You print it out, you and the buyer fill it out and hand it to the title company. And the title company's like, we'll call you in a couple of weeks and set up a closing date. And you're like, well, that was shockingly easy.
Very cool. So what were you doing in Alaska? I want to know how you get from Western Massachusetts to Antarctica eventually.
Oh, okay. Give me a second and I'll prepare the web, the road trip. Okay. So 2006 or maybe 2007, begin hiking the Appalachian Trail with my best friend. Make it partway and chase a woman to Alaska.
That old story.
she ended up leaving Alaska. I stayed for like 7 years. And mostly just worked in the summer doing a bunch of guiding, substitute teaching, working at a coffee shop, just whatever sort of kept the lights on. And Alaska's sort of that's how their economy functions, especially in the summer. I mean, it's just like there's tourists everywhere, and there's just like, I can work one day here and one day there and blah, blah, blah. But so did that for a while. One summer I was working as a guide on a glacier, and an acquaintance of mine who had been in Seward, which is the town in Alaska, the summer prior, was on a tour with me. And I was like, oh, like, I didn't see you last winter. What did you get up to? And she was like, oh, I got this job dishwashing. I was like, oh, bummer. And she's like, it was in Antarctica. And I was like, cool. Like, yeah. Tell me more. And she told me about it. And it sounded kind of neat. And at that point I must have been 27 or 28, probably 28. And it took me, I applied for like a year and a half before I finally got a call back to be a shuttle driver. So basically driving vans and like some, a variety of large polar equipment. Ooh, you hear that?
Yeah.
Yeah, big thunder. That's why I'm not outside right
now. Yeah, I get it now. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I went down as a shuttle driver, basically driving, I work on a research station called McMurdo Station, or I typically work at this station. And, you know, Randy, you're a scientist and you need to carry your box of fish embryos from over here to over there. You call up the shuttles department and they send me and I pick you up and drive you across town. Or pick people up at airplanes, whatnot. Yeah. And then since then, I've had a variety of positions leading up to the one I currently have, which I don't know if you want to hear about that, but.
Yes, I do. I want to hear all about it.
Okay.
Let me explain this. So, you know, normally this podcast has been adventure racers and stuff like that forever. And I've kind of run out of adventure racers to talk to, because I've talked to everybody.
Okay.
So
yeah,
I go, you know, I'm on Facebook and I'm looking at all these people I know and I'm like, oh, look what Dan does. That's really cool. I want to know everything about that. So I'm kind of going, okay. I'm going to go through all my friends list and all these people that have interesting jobs that to me, that's what we're going to focus on for a little while. So you're the first of this season, let's call it.
Cool. This cohort.
The interesting people with really cool jobs that I think I'd like, but I probably wouldn't.
Yeah. Which is funny, because when you sent me that message and I was like, I don't know if I've like ever actually talked to Randy. I think I've like done like the Tatanka horns as I've like ridden by on my bike or whatever. And thank you for all those pictures.
You're welcome.
Much obliged. I have a bunch of them all over the place. But I like, you're like doing, I'm transitioning my podcast to people I sort of know who do things that I think is pretty cool. And I was like, all right. It sounds like a reasonable pitch.
Before we get into what you're doing now, do you think your job is cool, or is it a job?
You know, that actually, I think that's a pretty good question. And the reason it's a good question is we call it deploying, but I've been deploying to Antarctica since 2011. So this year will be my, 11th season, 11th deployment, although I've spent winter there as well. But regardless, been going down long enough, and you can go down for between 5 and 9 months at a time. And sometimes you can go for an entire year, which I sort of recommend. Done it once. Basically what I'm getting at is I've spent enough time there that it is sort of part of like my real life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so when I'm down there and it's, I've been driving the shuttle for 4 years, it was kind of a job. It was just like, whatever. Like, I'm a taxi driver, but sometimes I have to drive this like, you know, 100-foot long crazy tractor with this thing behind it to pick up people at like a giant C-17 that landed on a runway made out of ice that's floating on the ocean. So, but then when you think about it like that, you're like, oh, it's not just a job. It's like, it is pretty cool. Yeah. So I think it's a little bit of both, would be another way to put that. Cause, yeah, sometimes what we're doing is some of the jobs, like my friend, the person who introduced me to Antarctica, was a dishwasher. Like, she, for the most part, washed dishes. But then when she'd go outside, she was in Antarctica.
Yeah.
So, yeah, my job now is, in fact, pretty cool. at least, I mean, other people can be the judge of it, but...
So what is the job now?
The job is called SPOT, and it is the South Pole Traverse. And what that means is, so I told you before, I work typically at a station called McMurdo, which is on an island off the coast of Antarctica, about 50 miles from the nearest landmass, or maybe a little less. And at least currently with the world, there is a permanent ice shelf that connects the island to the rest of the continent. So for all intents and purposes, McMurdo is attached to Antarctica. There is also a large research station, at the South Pole, the South Pole of the planet, also run by Americans. And that station runs on diesel fuel. And my job is I drive in a column of tractors, at times as many as 13 tractors. And these are giant tractors that you would probably see a less modified version of in a field in South Dakota. They're Caterpillar Challengers, but they're the big ones. And they have treads on them, big tracks. And behind each tractor drags 25,000 gallons of diesel fuel on these big crazy sheets of plastic. And it's 1,000 miles between McMurdo and the South Pole. And 25,000 gallons of diesel fuel plus the accoutrement, all the, you know, trailer hitches and all that stuff is 180,000 pounds or so. And so we drive these tractors like wickedly slow, like 4.5 miles an hour for 1,000 miles each way. But on the way home, since you don't have all the weight, you can go faster, like 8 miles an hour.
I was just gonna say 8 miles an hour.
we can go wicked fast. We go twice as fast. Wow. But during that time, I mean, so it sounds super cool, right?
Yeah.
Just work with me here. Sounds super cool, right?
Sounds super cool, yeah.
Yeah, but really a lot of it is you're alone in a tractor driving like painfully slowly, which gives you a lot of time to like listen to audiobooks or potentially this year, I might try to learn another language and just talk to myself in Spanish or something in the cab of this tractor. Because you're basically alone for close to 10 hours a day and you don't get a day off while you're traversing. I'm not traversing the whole time. There's a lot of prep work where we're at McMurdo and just, you know, I live in a dorm room or whatever, eat in a galley. Yeah. But yeah, so on the surface, it's a very cool job, but a lot of it is like just trundling along, driving this tractor, looking at endless flat white frozen wastelands.
So can you even sense movement? I mean, at 4 miles an hour in the middle of nothing, I mean, can you even tell you're moving? Uh-oh, we broke up. Hope it's not the thunderstorm. I came back. had to unmute you.
I think I'm unmuted.
That was me. Wi-Fi dropped out.
Okay. I thought maybe we had lost Wi-Fi, but I still had electricity. So
yeah, I'm thinking, thunderstorm, and I look up and it's like, it's trying to reconnect. So anyway, what I last asked you was, can you even tell that you're moving?
You can tell that you're moving. So sometimes we do have flat light, and it's, you can't really tell visually that you're moving, but I said you're in these tractors for like 10 hours a day, at times for like weeks on end, every single day. And it takes close to a month to get to the South Pole, and you don't get a day off. But so you're in this giant cab all alone, and you have like, you got your water bottles and your music and like extra gloves and your little snack bag, and you have stuff like all over the place, right?
Yeah.
And these tractors, they don't really have a suspension to speak of. And the snow out there, a lot of times it's very flat, or you're driving behind another tractor that sort of packed it down. But some of the snow is packed like concrete and very bumpy. And these tractors, sometimes you'll be driving and it'll go up on something, and then it reaches its critical mass, its turning point. And you're just sitting, you've been zoning out, whatever. And then all of a sudden, all your stuff just like flies everywhere. And then you can definitely tell that you're moving. And it's pretty impressive how much stuff can shake around at 3.5, 4.5 miles an hour. It's can be pretty jarring and dramatic.
Yeah.
Just thinking.
And then you're like, oh, the high point of my day. I get to rearrange my cab again.
Yep. And you can do all that while it's moving, because you don't need to use your feet to control the thing. And there's nothing to hit. So
how do you, and I know this from experience many, many years ago, driving a D4 or something, pulling a Packer, just driving in circles. And it's like, I more than once was like, oh yeah, I'm supposed to be doing something. I mean, is it like a long distance driver? You just learn how to do it, you just get used to it? Or, I mean, how hard is it to keep focused?
I think it probably varies for different people. Every once in a while, and again, I said we're driving in a column, essentially, so just in a big old train of tractors. And every once in a while, and it never happened to me, not yet, not to say it can't, but you'll just see a tractor just sort of start driving off towards nowhere, and you'll be like, oh, Randy. And everyone has a cab radio, so you can always be in contact. And they'll be like, Randy, this is your morning wake up call. Like, and you see the tractor sort of come back. So, yeah, I mean, some people watch movies and TV shows. They have their laptop. So a big thing that comes in handy is like that sticky Velcro. So you can like stick it to the bottom of your computer and then to the top of your little shelf in your tractor.
Yeah.
Velcro and magnets are like the two good things. But yeah, I think people fend off boredom and zoning out in a variety of ways.
Yeah.
I, for the most part, listen to books and podcasts unless I'm doing something that I do have to pay attention to.
Yeah.
Like if we're backing up, and you can't back up the trailer, but we have to back up to fuel or to like use a crane. Some of these tractors have cranes on the back of them. And, you know, like I'll listen to music, something I don't have to like be paying attention to, essentially.
Pretty much distracted driving isn't a real big concern.
The what driving?
Distracted driving.
Oh no. Yeah. I mean, people are super distracted driving. But again, we all match the same RPM. So we're traveling at the same speed. Like no one's merging or like driving all crazy. So, you can be distracted. Maybe that's like a horrible ad for my job, but.
I'm a podcast guy and a music guy too. I mean, I could, I could probably deal with that. Just I have my queue of podcasts never ends, and I never even get close. And all of a sudden, I'm like, oh, look at this one. Oh, 200 episodes. Well, I better get started.
I mean, last year, I spent 9 months on the job, and I drove to the South Pole twice over the course of that time, and then had a ton of other time in a tractor. And I listened to, I mean, thousands of hours of digital media, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, Stuff You Should Know and like comedy podcasts, tons of books. I mean, you can go through a serious backlog of podcasts. Let me tell you, knocking out like 10 or 12 a day.
I mean, I kind of like, like when I went and picked up her van, you know, driving back, it's like, oh yes, I've got like 12 hours to just to listen to a podcast. So what's like your top three or four podcasts you like?
Okay. I'll give you my top four, 'cause they're like, totally the top four. Stuff You Should Know.
Yep.
Because it's fascinating. Agreed. Yeah. Josh and Chuck, man, they're so good. Stuff You Should Know. I really like the podcast called Risk, which is a storytelling podcast. Some of the stories are super hilarious. Some are like super tragic. It's sort of a mixed bag, but it's just very... very good podcast, in my opinion. Yeah. A friend of mine introduced me to it. Risk, My Brother, My Brother and Me, which are these three brothers.
I've heard one of theirs, I think.
They all have their own podcast as well. And like them and their spouses, like, they're a podcasting family, but the three of them together are pretty hilarious. And they've been podcasting since like 2010 or something, you know, so they have quite a following. And then the one that would round out my top four is Dude, which is just these two friends that they call themselves the Pod Fathers because they've been podcasting since 2006, and they're one of the first podcasts ever, and I think they are the longest running podcast ever. And they're just these two guys just shoot the shit for an hour every week. Can I swear on this podcast?
Yeah, I don't care.
A minimum.
All tens of my listeners don't care either. Nice. No WTF?
With Mark Maron?
Yeah.
I used to listen to that, and I think I just sort of like stopped.
I mean, I found that I've had ones that I've listened to for years, and then all of a sudden it's like, nah.
Yeah.
And then you realize, you know, you don't have to listen to every one.
Like, yeah. And that, so I guess the top, those four that I just told you are the ones that I listen to every one. I've listened to the Mark Maron podcast. Like another podcast I really enjoy is Stuff You Missed in History Class, which is, you know, I mean, it's in the same family as Stuff You Should Know, but it's just all historical stuff. Yeah. But some of them are like, I don't know. It's just not my style. And that's fine.
Yeah.
And I like a lot of the true crime podcasts, you know, like I've listened to all the Serial and whatever and all those little offshoots. And I think that's a fantastic genre for me anyways.
I suppose that's pretty engaging for you. I've never got into any of the live or the true crime ones. Other than there's a guy, it's not really a true crime, but sort of a true crime. What's it called? Shoot. Something. It's like true bad side of Hollywood.
Oh yeah. Like, true life. I don't know. True.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's always the dark side.
Anyway. Yeah. I listened to one just recently called Dr. Death, which is about, I mean, it's essentially true crime, but it's about how this like doctor was allowed to practice and was like a total quack, you know, but
just an FYI, Zoom might kick us out in 10 minutes. And if he does, I'll just send another link. It's never has before.
It like threatens you.
Yeah.
Okay.
If it does, cause I don't think we'll quite be done yet. I'll just send you another link and we'll just start again.
Yeah, all good.
So, so when do you go? When do you head south?
So there's sort of two main deployment times each year. Okay, I'll amend that. There's sort of three main deployment times each year. So McMurdo Station is occupied year round. You know, there's people there year round. Same with the South Pole. And so the start of the season, the end of the winter, which we're coming out of right now, is sort of marked by what is typically in the early to middle part of August, a series of flights to Antarctica called Winfly, as in winter flight, Winfly. And there's usually like 3 to 5 flights of 150 to 240 people, as well as a variety of cargo. Because a lot of times we're flying down on these C-17 Globemaster, like these huge cargo planes. And over the course of an entire winter in Antarctica, you can imagine a lot of equipment and whatnot breaks. And they're like, if you're sending a few flights down, we need like this starter, this what, you know. So they're filled with all the like, we need this stuff to get everything up and running for 6 weeks past Winfly. So like I said, Winfly, middle of August, roughly the start of main body, or the main part of like the year when most of the business, quote unquote, or the science is happening in Antarctica. Main body starts end of September, early October. And so most people will come at main body. So in the summer at McMurdo Station, roughly 900 people, probably like 500 of them come at main body, 200 of them come at Winfly. I'm this year one of those 200. So have the distinct pleasure of leaving summer in the Northern Hemisphere early, missing the Dakota 5-0, which is like a major bummer.
Yeah.
And traveling to New Zealand via commercial planes, and then waiting for a weather window to go to Antarctica, where August is traditionally the worst weather of the year there. As the seasons sort of change, it's just prone to ferocious storms. It gets dark at night still in August. It's cold, it's windy, like your nose is chapped and bleeding and everything. But you also get to see some amazing clouds and phenomenon in the sky. So going at Winfly is kind of cool. It's also just like, oh, like all my friends are at home getting tanned and I'm getting frostbite. So, So I'm leaving in less than a month to answer your question.
So how come New Zealand and not South America?
Yep.
Is it closer?
Well, no. Okay. The South America bit is only, I think, like 600 or 700 miles from the Antarctic Peninsula.
Yeah.
And so the United States has 3 year-round operational bases. One is McMurdo, one is the South Pole, and the third one is called Palmer Station, which you do access from South America via a vessel, and you travel through Drake Passage, which is the worst other body of water in the world. I have never traveled to Palmer Station. I would love to. So the reason we go through New Zealand is because New Zealand is closer than Australia to McMurdo. But if like New Zealand suffered another major earthquake or something, Hobart, which is in Tasmania off the coast of Australia, is like an alternate port for us, essentially.
Yeah. So like last year, were you able to go through New Zealand? Because weren't they shut down?
Yeah. Well, So last year, the deployment process, usually in non-COVID times, the deployment procedure is you get ticketed, you fly from your home airport, you know, mine up until last year was Rapid City, or up until this year was Rapid City, to a major airport on the West Coast. So usually LAX or SFO, occasionally Dallas. And then you fly, you know, to New Zealand, and it takes, you know, whatever, 20 to 30 hours, depending on layovers and whatnot. You also lose a day,
when you
go there. But then you get to New Zealand, spend the night in the hotel. The next day, you like watch a bunch of PowerPoints. You get issued your cold weather clothing. We all like, they don't just let you go down with your shorts and t-shirt, obviously. So we get issued all kinds of, like, they call it ECW or extreme cold weather gear. Big boots, Carhartt bibs, like big warm coat, you know, a little bit of everything. And then in theory, you fly the next day. So total from leaving your home to arriving in Antarctica, 3 to 4 days. There's almost always a weather delay. So you can probably assume, unless everything's perfect and you get that 3 days, which kind of sucks because then you don't get to spend any time in New Zealand. It usually, I mean, it's going to take, you know, four to, well, I'll tell you the longest I've ever had, but up until last year, the longest I ever had delay was 16 days. And in that time, you're being put up in a hotel and you're in this pretty cool, I think it's pretty cool, city called Christchurch in New Zealand on the South Island. And you can just go do whatever, you know, I mean, there's like, there's music, there's food all over the place. There's like this awesome botanic garden. There's just like a bunch of stuff to do. And it's springtime there. Like it's, you know, it's a lot of times it's like drizzly and rainy, but, so usually three to five days from leaving home, getting to work. Last year with all the COVID precautions, we had, 5 days. So you get to San Francisco was our airport of departure this year or last year, San Francisco, 5 days in the hotel at the airport where we'd only get let outside once or sometimes twice. And you could like walk around the building in a clockwise direction. And then you had to go back to your room. Only one person could ride the elevator at a time. Like it was quite a pain in the butt. But then we were put on a chartered airplane, chartered, you know, it was like a 777 or something, pretty big, like a wide body jet, and flown to New Zealand. But we had to stop in Honolulu for like 5 hours to refuel, during which time we could not get off the planes and we weren't supposed to leave our seats. And it was just like, oh my God, we're going to be like literally on this plane for like 22 hours. And we were, but so we just had 5 days plus another day on a plane. So that's six. Landed in New Zealand, and New Zealand at the time was implementing MIQ.
And now part two.
We're not supposed to be dressed the same this time, are we?
No.
Is it a purely audio?
We don't have to. We don't have to pretend I screwed it up and didn't press record. So I'll tell everybody that in my intro. It's not the first time that it's happened. No, but we did switch. Outside. I'm inside.
Yeah, it's not thunderstorming. So, and I think I get pretty good coverage here. Yeah, looks like it works fine. Where were we?
Well, first of all, where'd you go to supper?
oh
I went to a place I've never been before in the town of Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, called the Blue Rock Restaurant. It was very good.
What'd you have?
Yeah, with a couple of old. I had Grandma Joe's enchiladas. it was a very eclectic menu, the selection, but all the food. I went with three other people, my fiance and then two family friends that I've known for 30 plus years or whatever. And we all had different things. Actually, I guess two of us got the enchiladas, but it was all like very good and very flavorful. And like everything was, it was good. And I've never been there before. Never heard of it. Yeah.
There you go. All right. So we were at 6 days. You're going to.
Oh man. We were way back.
Yeah.
Am I coming in choppy for you? You're a little choppy for me.
A little bit. It's not bad, but.
Okay.
It says we're unstable.
Okay. Let me just run inside. I'll just bring the computer back to where we were. That'll probably make it easier. Oh, good. Try not to pour the beer into the keyboard because that would be.
Yeah.
I'd hate to say it. I've never done that before, but that would be a lie.
I haven't, knock wood, but I don't have a beer. I have a glass of Kool-Aid, but it's on a different table.
Is this better? Sarah, I'll just sit in the, I'll sit over here. It'll be fine. Being interviewed for a podcast, will my talking be too loud for you? No. Okay. Cool. I guess I'll just sit in the living room then. But then we might get interrupted by my brother-in-law who's putting my nephew to bed upstairs. We'll make it work. Okay.
The podcast has been photobombed before, so.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure.
What was the one? Oh, somebody. I asked somebody what was up for the rest of the year, you know, what's their next race or whatever. And he's telling me in the other room, he's like, his wife's like, you're going to do what? First she'd heard of it.
Busted.
But that's one of those things. Well, if you can't argue in public. So, you bring it up when people are around.
No. Again, I'm getting married next year, so I got to learn these things.
There you go. I'm full of tips. Get there, because this is kind of a good thing, because there's some things I wanted to ask, but I forgot. Did you meet your fiance on the ice, or did you convince her to go, that she should go down there?
Nope, we met in Antarctica, 6 years ago, almost 6 years ago. Yeah, quite a while ago, really. But she was a scientist. I was a lowly support staff worker unloading planes or something. And our love blossomed from there. We met down there for sure.
I mean, is that kind of common, or is that fairly rare?
A ton of people meet at least people they get into relationships with, for sure. And a lot of people do meet their future spouses. Absolutely.
It kind of makes sense. If you're of the mindset to go work in Antarctica, you're probably compatible if you're both there.
Maybe. There's a lot of different types of personalities and whatnot. Hold on 1 second. Hey, Jared, are you going to be coming over here soon? Okay. And I might move this upstairs one more time, Randy.
We're fine.
Yeah. Then we'll be able to stop moving. So I have to extricate my fiance now, Marcy. Let's see.
you know, she's probably got a whole different story than what you've been telling me, but we'll keep that under wraps.
Yeah, right over here. Marcy, do you mind if I take the room again? Thank you. Okay. Yeah. I'll see you in a little bit. Okay.
Now if I put on that pink shirt or that orange shirt or whatever color it was I was wearing yesterday, you won't be able to tell.
Nobody will know, except we stopped in the middle of one conversation and started in the other. But all right, now we'll get back to 6 days. Here, finish the story.
Okay, so there I was, 6 days in a hotel in an airport. And then we arrive in New Zealand, at which point we have a mandatory 14 days of New Zealand military managed isolation in a hotel, in like a specific hotel that's right at the airport. So that's 6 days plus 14 days is 20 days. And then due to nasty weather, airplanes breaking, and of all things, the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan, taking a lot of our airplane resources overseas, or I guess away from New Zealand, which is not a high priority, I don't think, in terms of what's going on militarily in New Zealand. But ultimately ended up with 40 days from the day I started my travels to getting to work was 40 days later. And it was not amazing. I mean, it was a unique experience to spend that much time sequestered in three various hotels on two different continents, but it's an experience I could do without, for sure.
Yeah. Hopefully this year goes a little better, right?
Yep. And yeah, we should have nothing beyond standard weather delays, which are always expected, but there shouldn't be any sort of quarantine or that kind of extended stay on the deployment process to Antarctica.
So I'm not trying to recreate the conversation, but I do remember some of the things I asked you. So one that I thought was pretty interesting that we talked about was the weather when you're in the convoy. You know, how can you keep moving?
Right.
You know, how does that work?
Absolutely. So the weather, I think you asked what, like, can we travel when it's nasty out?
Yeah.
And the quick answer is we can travel in weather that, if you were like outside hiking, would be like gale force, you know, I mean, it would be incredible. But when you're driving a huge diesel powered tractor across Antarctica, as long as you can see a little ways, you're not going to get like blown around by the wind or pushed off course. I mean, you're in this like huge vehicle. The caveat to that being is if something breaks, like it has to get fixed by the mechanics. And then it's like, well, we are outside and doing stuff, but you can also park another vehicle next to a disabled vehicle as a windbreak. But on the first of the two trips that I did last year, it took 30 days to get to the South Pole. And over the course of that time, we had a bunch of nasty weather. We had one day where we did not go anywhere due to weather, because it was a heinous whiteout. I mean, it was 20 feet of visibility maximum, sustained for over a day. I mean, for over 24 hours, it was like the craziest whiteout. And so basically it was like, we can't go anywhere safely, and there's like absolutely no reason for anyone or anything to get damaged or injured. And so we just hung out and, you know, watched, yeah. Like, I think I started and potentially finished an entire, gosh, I started some TV show. Can't even remember what, but like a single episode or a single season series, mini series, whatever. God, what was it? Yeah. Whatever.
They all run together. Let's see. How does this question go? How predictable is the weather? So like when you're sitting there in a whiteout like that, do you know that it's going to be 24 hours or it's going to be 2 weeks or do you not, can they not tell?
Yeah. So,
good answer.
Yeah. I mean, there's not a ton of weather stations out there. That being said, there are some, and some of them are near the route we take. And so while we're driving, like during the day, one person, the leader, you know, like the boss or whatever, has a, like an inReach unit that has whatever subscription to the weather is, and he gets weather updates based on, you know, computer models of like, it's probably gonna be this temperature with this visibility and this cloud cover, or like and I would say, you know, if you get that for New York City, it's probably pretty spot on because there's like so many data points. For out here, it's like, oh, there's, you know, not a lot of them. So the weather was usually generally accurate. It's going to be pretty windy tomorrow. Okay, cool. Well, like, I mean, is that 20 miles an hour or is it like 50 all day? Like, because there's a difference. I mean, you might get word that it's going to be windy for several days, but again, does that mean if it's not picking up and blowing the snow, then the wind is inconvenient, but it's not something that hampers you per se. Where it does hamper you is, so like, I don't know if we've said this before, but not only are we bringing fuel, one of the tractors in the convoy has all of our buildings, our like sleeping quarters, our galley where we eat, and like a toilet that's an incinerating toilet. So you can't pee in it, but you can poop in it. Yeah. And then you press a little special button and you have to poop in this special little party hat thing, but it incinerates it. But we have a few buildings with us. We're not sleeping in the cabs or setting up tents every night. But when it's really windy out, so the outsides of these buildings, they're not just like, I mean, they're usually a modified shipping container, essentially. But they might have a deck where we also store 55-gallon drums of hydraulic fluid for all the hydraulics on the tractors, or spare whatever parts for these tractors or these sleds that we're towing. And so there's a lot of like bungee cords and like little straps and stuff, which is fine. But then in the wind, if you got a little bungee cord with like a little metal hook on the end and it's just tunk, 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 tunk on the outside of the wall where you sleep, it's like, am I going to go out there in like my Crocs and underwear and it's like negative 20 and I'm going to be outside for like 90 seconds, hopefully. To hang up this hook or to like tuck this thing behind something. So that's really, in my experience, where the wind was the most annoying thing, was when it would like cause something like a noise and you're just like, can't concentrate.
I get that. Is that one of those games everybody just pretends that they're asleep and hope somebody else will go?
One of my roommates this year, this guy, I'm not even going to use his name, love him to death. And I just saw him the other day, super nice guy. But he'd always like leave his bungee cord. I speak from experience. He'd leave his little bungee cord hanging and I'd always be like, dude, just like when you take off your bungee cord, just hook it on this little thing. Like, it takes an extra half second. He's like, oh, I'll try. But he just always forgot. So whatever. I try to remember to check before I went to bed. I'd be like out there brushing my teeth or something and be like, aha, hang it up. Yeah. Nobody has to worry about it.
There you go.
Small.
Do you have many mechanicals? 1,000 miles is a long ways to go.
1,000 miles each way.
Each way, like, yeah. That's
true. Round trip is 2,000 miles. Yeah, we do. But sometimes a mechanical, so again, these are giant tractors. Yeah. Anyone who's listening, or you obviously, can look it up. It's called a Challenger MT-865C. And if you just look up like Antarctic Challenger tractor on the internet, yeah, it'll pop up with these like big yellow tractors that we drive. But they are relatively modern. So sometimes a mechanical is like, I got an alert that my air filter needs to be changed or whatever.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's like, oh, I looked out the rear view window and I lost 50 gallons of hydraulic fluid because my like filter exploded off the tractor or whatever. And so the mechanics, and we bring quite a few mechanics. There are quite a few mechanics who are also drivers. Everyone's driving, but then some people are also mechanics or like have other roles. But yeah, so I mean, it's total crapshoot. But in that, yeah, those temperatures and like the sizes and weights of everything, there's just like, it's hardware on everything. So yeah, I mean, we've had tractors break down where we end up leaving them if we're on our way there to the South Pole, where there's limited resources to repair one of these tractors. It's like, well, if we're halfway there, we can transfer all the fuel out of their load because they're broken down. We can put it in the other loads and just leave the whole thing on the side of the road. And when we come back, we can put it on the, like, we have special sleds for exactly this kind of thing. And you just put the tractor on little sleds and you just drag it behind you. So sometimes you have like catastrophic mechanicals, and sometimes you just have like, oh, my track tension sensor is showing that I'm low on pressure on the right side, something that needs to be addressed, but it's not catastrophic. Like, oh, it's just an adjustment we make. It takes 20 minutes or whatever. Yeah, we bring a ton of spare parts, you know, spare turbochargers, spare all kinds of stuff. One of the buildings that we bring with us is the tool shed, and it is filled with, yeah, just all kinds of parts for these tractors.
Interesting. So I am guessing at least once, maybe not for you, but you know, you don't have the part. It's like, this one's never broke, but there's always a first time, right?
Yeah. So so it's actually funny you say that. So I said turbocharger, and it turns out that we didn't have the spare turbocharger. Yeah, so one of my friend's tractors, the turbocharger just like sort of came apart, and the tractor could only creep at like 0.5 miles per hour at like 1200, you know, it was crippled.
Yeah.
We were 3 days from the South Pole, and it was just like, if it can still move right now, we'll drive it up on the little sleds and we'll just like, the person who was driving this tractor will drive and just, they'll just ride in their bunk room. Cause like, yeah, where else are you going to go? To sit out in bed, whatever. And they just rode the last like 3 days to the South Pole doing nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've talked about how nothing isn't that much fun. The first day it's pretty fun. Second day, not so much.
Yeah, so it definitely loses its luster. For sure.
It's like, I'm out here, I might as well be doing something.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, so the other thing that I was pretty interested in is it a job job or is it still an adventure?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's both. And it's sort of fluid. It changes between those two. I think I told you that I've had several positions over my time on the ice. And, you know, the first year of doing something, like, it's super exciting. I'm learning everything and yada, yada, yada. The second year, you're like, okay, cool. Like, I can do this. I can certainly learn some new stuff, but like everything's under control. There's no like any curveball that comes. I at least know the framework of my job. The next year it's like my learning curve has sort of dropped off. Cause at this point, like 2 years of doing whatever, you've seen a lot of the stuff that can happen. Like, oh, when it's whatever temperature it is, this doohickey stops working or this thing happens to whatever. And then it does sort of become a job. But then I can't speak for other people, but, you know, a day after having a super boring day at work might end up with a helicopter flight to a place where there's actually, it's quite, you can see the pictures online. Like a crashed airplane that is out by where one of our runways used to be called Pegasus. And it's a super constellation that crashed in 1971 or something in a whiteout. And now it's, you can sort of see the hulk of this plane and like the rear tail sticking out. And you wouldn't actually take a helicopter there. You could actually drive there. But the point is that sometimes it's just a job. Sometimes you're like, holy cow, like, look at this thing. Or like, I'm at the South Pole because I just drove here. Or, you know, look, there's an active volcano behind the station. Now that we're talking again, Randy, it's kind of like, oh, I didn't tell you that like McMurdo Station is 20 miles from the southernmost active volcano in the world. And it's like this giant volcano, Mount Erebus, with like a plume of smoke that comes out of it all the time. Wow. It's kind of neat that it's like the backdrop of McMurdo Station is this huge mountain.
Yeah. Is it still a little pretty cool every time you get to the South Pole?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely something to be said for, I mean, getting to a pretty unique place on the planet, absolutely. And I mean, and when you get there nowadays, there's like this huge telescope and this like space age station and a bunch of like pretty wild stuff. But also think about how in 1911, people were like dying trying to get back from here. And it's like, I just rode like listening to my book on tape in like a heated cab eating like Snickers bar, you know? Yeah. And it's like, man, some people like risked their lives and in some cases paid with their lives to get to where I'm going in relative ease and comfort, you know? So it's also kind of humbling to get there and be like, okay, this place has history, even though it's this empty expanse of air and nothingness.
I will, I actually just remembered this, but I actually had a guest on that she rode her bike to the South Pole.
Oh, okay. So, right on.
I'll have to link the two podcasts together, but that was just one of many things. That was even like one of the coolest things she did. But so is there a ritual the first time you get to the South Pole? You know, there is across the equator and the ships and stuff like that, or instead of that, is what's the like the stupidest thing you've seen somebody do at the South Pole?
I don't think I've seen anyone do anything especially stupid at the South Pole. But there are like funny things. So at the South Pole station, underneath it, and you can go down here, there's this whole system of snow tunnels that have been you know, cut by people into the snow below the station. And through them run a lot of the utilities, essentially. So the South Pole Station is this big station that can accommodate, I think, up to 150-ish people. But guess what? People need to A, drink, and B, after they drink, use the bathroom.
Yeah.
And you can't just dump all that out. So A, where do you get the water? And B, where do you put the wastewater? The answer to that question is a thing called a rod well, which is essentially a heating element on a rod that is dropped down into the ice, and it heats essentially just a big bulb of liquid water out of the ice. And I can't be quoted on any of these numbers. But basically the Rodwell ends up making, it's the teardrop that it makes is huge. I mean, it is, I think from top to bottom, it's like 400 feet tall. And I think they try to keep like a third of it as liquid water. So, I mean, it's like, it's a serious endeavor to keep liquid water in a subterranean ice cave. But so that's where the drinking water comes from. And the effluent goes to the previous empty bulb. So in like, you know, a million years, when the ice at the South Pole reaches the coast, there's going to be these like, and the, so far there's only been like four of these or whatever over the course of however many years a station has been at the South Pole, I think was from the 60s. Or 70s, like not very long, but eventually there'll be these like huge shitbergs that'll come out. But again, I mean, in like a million years,
yeah. More. So that's pretty cool. Yeah. See,
it's pretty cool. But okay, so you were asking about crazy things, though. So within these tunnels, some of them go out to the Rodwell, but in these tunnels, people have carved these like altars. And so this is the crazy part, that you'll be walking. And several years ago, Edwin Eugene Aldrin, AKA Buzz Aldrin, did a, I think he was on a trip with like some Russians, believe it or not, I think, to the South Pole. And he got like altitude sickness and had to be medevaced. And was, and you know, is still alive, whatever. But so in one of these little like altars carved into the snow in these subterranean ice caves or ice tunnels, there's like a little plexiglass box with a pedestal with like two or three used tissues sitting on it. And then there's like this little engraved plaque that says, Buzz Aldrin's actual tissues, caution, space germs. And it's just one of those weird, like, someone took the time to like, are those actually his tissues? I have no idea, but it's pretty hilarious. There's also in one of these altars a huge sturgeon, like a fish, this giant frozen sturgeon just sitting there. It's been there for years. But I haven't seen anyone do anything especially stupid there. I'm not saying that especially stupid things have not happened there.
I suppose, actually, because you guys are like theoretically workers, it's probably the tourists that do the dumb stuff. Might be my guess.
So there are in fact tourists that come to the South Pole. They do not stay at the Admonson Scott South Pole Station, that is United States Station. They have a tourist camp that is about half mile or quarter mile from the station. And barring emergencies, you know, life or death emergencies, we have nothing to do with that. If they needed medevac or something, like, obviously we're not going to be like, oh, like, we're just going to let you die. but they can't just be like, oh, hey, like we came over for lunch. Yeah, so there are definitely people who work in Antarctica who do dumb things. You have to look out for the people who do the dumb things and get caught for them. There's a difference.
There you go.
I mean, everyone does dumb things.
Yeah.
Or irresponsible things. But So I've definitely heard, like at McMurdo, where I've spent quite a bit of time, there are definitely some dumb stories that I could tell you, but probably shouldn't.
We maybe shouldn't go there. So this is a yes or no question. Is there one person that, when their name's mentioned, everybody knows what he did?
Well, so the quick answer is no.
No.
The slightly longer answer is there's way more than one of those people.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, and that also goes on a rotating basis. So, you know, like there are some legendary stories, obviously, of like, oh, this guy who still works here, like he one time caused like this huge diesel spill. True story. I know this guy who's like caused a huge diesel spill. Long story, but then there's also, you know, oh, someone did something stupid Saturday night and got sent to HR and like they might get fired or something. You know, you might be famous for the weekend.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's definitely like people who are like legends and fixtures or whatever. It's like, oh yeah, I've heard of that person even if I've never met him, you know.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. So we're going to run out of time again, and I don't want to take up all of your Friday night, but what's an A-bomb?
What's an A-bomb? Oh, yeah. So the A-bomb, the A-bomb is when you basically say the word Antarctica to anyone. Well, not to anyone. Some people are just like, oh, yeah, like Anchorage, Antarctica? And you're like, no, Anchorage is in Alaska. Other side. So people get confused with the North. But I think what I told you last night was that so a lot of people in Antarctica have traveled quite extensively. And I think they've, for the most part, have all been in a hostel or some sort of situation where, you know, you're relaxing after having been in Antarctica for a while. And there's some, you know, other traveler who's loud mouthing and talking about all the places they've been and how like, oh, I went to Angkor Wat and, you know, saw the Great Wall of China and blah, 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 and all this stuff. And then if they deign to talk to you and ask you where you've been, or if you just want to be like, I'm going to crush this fool. you know, you can essentially mention or however it comes up in conversation to sort of mention like, oh, I worked in Antarctica, blah, blah. And it's like, all of a sudden their stories aren't very cool anymore.
Yeah.
that's dropping the A-bomb is like, but a lot of times you don't want to drop the A-bomb. Like my fiance and I, if we go out to dinner with my parents' friends, it's like, we can either just have like a normal dinner where we all hang out, or we can be the center of attention and get like peppered with questions, and it's kind of exhausting sometimes.
Yeah, I'll raise my hand. I'm guilty of that right now.
Well, but yeah. you explicitly asked ahead of time too.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
I can see where it could get a little old, and you just want to have a normal conversation and go on like that. So when do you leave? I know, I think it's roughly, but everybody else does.
Yeah. Yeah. So the second week of August, middle of August, head down. Many people, like my fiance included, will head down in late September or early October, which is when, you know, at least 50% of the people deploy. I'll go down with, you know, sort of the vanguard of 20 or 30% of the people for the season.
But yeah, are you down there? It's go ahead.
I was gonna say, you do you go down there to basically like prep and get stuff ready for everybody else? Is that kind of where you're at? Yep.
So. Yeah, absolutely. And again, this is changing gears. I'm totally fine to, like, if you want to log back on for even just a few minutes, whatever, just to make it
okay.
But either way, but yeah, we go down early season to get ready for the main bulk of the people who will then show up in, again, September or early October, when the season really gets sort of kicking into gear. That's when all the science, or much of the science, begins happening. Yeah, and just sort of, you know, everything gets up and running. So yeah, kind of going in as the early crew to sow prep the garden batch, kind of.
So, all right, let's log off and come back on, because I've got a couple more questions.
Yeah, so we'll just absolutely
stop. All right,
okay,
I'll be back.
And now part three, because I did come back.
Okay. And I did hit the recording button. at least it only takes me one time to realize what I did. All right, so what we talked about yesterday was what your day is like. So we'll do that, and then what kind of science is going on, if there's anything really cool. So any order you want. So what,
okay.
Yeah. So what's your day like? What's your work day like?
So what's my day like? Okay, so I have sort of two templates for my workday. One is my workday when I am at McMurdo or potentially at the South Pole. I work a 10-hour day that starts at 7 and ends at 5 p.m. So morning meetings at 7. If you want breakfast, which like I super do because it's going to be cold outside. I'm going to get hungry. But you know, so you get breakfast on your own time, but we have a galley no matter where we are. You don't have to pay for food or anything. But so I usually get up at 6-ish, whatever, brush my teeth, go to the galley, which is in another building. I live in a dorm room in a little suite. So it's me and my fiance. Then we have our suite mates that we've had for several years. And then I go to work, and morning meeting starts at 7. And the Traverse supervisor lines out what the day is going to look like. Randy, you're going out to do XYZ. Dan, you got whatever detail. And so your day from day to day can totally vary. And throughout the course of 10 hours, I mean, 10 hours is a long time. So you can do a bunch of different things. But when you're on station at McMurdo or the South Pole, when we're at McMurdo, we're doing prep work for the most part for driving to the South Pole. We are filling the bladders. We are making sure we have all the food we need. We're making sure all the tractors, you know, any of the mechanical issues that we've noticed while we're driving them locally around McMurdo are addressed, and they're good to go for like what is a pretty epic road trip, even though it's slow and not super far. And then, you know, I mean, we get an hour for lunch from whatever, noon to one or whatever, then work until 5 and go home. When we are on the trail, on the road, driving to the South Pole, we work 7 12-hour days a week, every day from the day we leave McMurdo until we get to the South Pole. So no days off, no down days, barring heinous weather. And that day pretty much consists of same thing, morning meeting at 7, and then driving your tractor for upwards of 10 hours a day, and then having a couple of breaks to check your load or whatever, a lunch break also to, you know, have lunch, stretch your legs a little bit. Yeah, and then rinse, repeat until you get to the South Pole, or you get back from the South Pole, depends on which way you're headed.
Do the days just all run together? Do you have to look at your phone to know what day it is?
Well, I mean, there's no point in looking at your phone, know what day it is, because it doesn't matter. They don't care.
Racing, you know, for an expedition race, it's like every, it's like this, a tour to the south, to the tour to Antarctica is 3 days. The first day, the last day, and the one in the middle.
Yeah. So again, sometimes, but then sometimes there's a crazy weather day.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, if it's just bright and sunny out yesterday and today, and I just drove at the same speed behind the same tractor for 10 hours and like still couldn't see anything out of any of my windows all the way to the horizon. Like, yeah, those days do kind of blend together. Sort of near the midpoint of the traverse, we drive from essentially sea level to up onto the Antarctic plateau, which is approaching 2 miles above sea level. And we do that in over the course of not very many miles in essentially 2 days. And that is an incredibly cool time because we drive through the Trans-Antarctic Mountains, which is this huge mountain range that essentially holds back the Antarctic plateau. Like, I mean, hundreds of thousands and millions of square miles of ice is held back by this huge mountain range, and we drive up one of the glaciers called the Leverett Glacier. But it's very cool, and it's just this, like, you drive through the mountains for like 2 days, and then you're back out on flat high altitude nothingness instead of flat low altitude nothingness.
So see, I would, I know this isn't true, but I'm assuming, you get in your tractor and you just drive a flat straight line and you get to the South Pole. No, you got to go up 10,000 feet, huh? Roughly.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Like 9,500 feet or whatever. You drive in a straight line at times for like a couple weeks at the exact same head every day. I mean, the first 550 or 600 miles of the traverse, you make two or three turns in the first 30 miles. And then it is literally dead straight for like 500 plus miles. And I mean, I called my fiance one day and was like, we turned right, you know, we had a turn.
It's a big day.
It was a big day. And then for the next like 50 miles, we just went straight on that course. But yeah, for a lot of the time you're traveling and you look at your little GPS screen and it's in between 359 degrees and 0 degrees. I guess that's when you're heading north, but so, you know, it's like you're driving like dead south.
Dead 180.
And then you get to the South Pole and every direction is north from the South Pole. There's like no east or west when you're there. Yeah. Which is kind of weird.
Yes, it is a little freaky to think about. I know one thing we need to mention. So when you're in the middle of the traverse, who are your closest neighbors?
Yeah. Well, aside from the other people who are with me, the space station is the closest people. I mean, that's just, they're just the closest people.
Just mind bending. So, yeah, this is so cool. So, science. So what's the cool science going on at the Egg McMurdo?
Okay, yeah. So the whole reason that, in theory, the entire reason that anyone is in Antarctica is either for science or to support science. So like in my case, I'm supporting science by providing fuel and supplies for the South Pole station. McMurdo and the South Pole both have a lot of science. They have a lot of different science. So at McMurdo, which is on the coast and one side of the island in the summer, typically the seasonal sea ice breaks out and we have open water. seals, penguins, minke whales, orcas,
polar bears.
There is polar bears, all the polar bears. Yeah, that's one of our common questions. I don't know if that was in.
I think we talked about that before, but yeah, that's why I think I threw it in there.
Yeah, totally. But yeah, so there is a lot of like marine biology science that goes on at McMurdo. There is also locally, there's an area called the Dry Valleys, which are a unique in the world location, as are many things in Antarctica. But the Dry Valleys are essentially a place where snow does not accumulate, oddly. And so they're these giant frigid desert valleys that are a relatively short helicopter's flight from McMurdo, you know, I mean, an hour or so away from McMurdo Station. And there's this area of great scientific curiosity because there are, even though it's Antarctica and it at first blush looks totally barren, there are, you know, there's all kinds of bacteria and other little tardigrades and stuff that they're finding in the soil and in some of the ice and liquid water that is incredibly saline and mineral rich. But yeah, so there's all kinds of science nearby there. There is like a LIDAR project that shoots a laser into the sky. There is atmospheric science where they're measuring the amount of like dissolved whatever chlorine and other metals and whatnot in the upper atmosphere. There's also a thing called LDB, or the Long Duration Balloon Facility, which is quite fascinating. And they, instead of putting stuff on a spaceship to go into space, which is incredibly expensive, you know, I mean, $10,000 a pound or whatever, an LDB balloon, a long duration balloon, can carry a crazy telescope or whatever piece of science equipment up to close to the edge of the atmosphere, you know, 120,000 feet, like 26 kilometers above Earth. And the air current during the summer season circles Antarctica, the continent, but then as it becomes winter, it sort of spreads outward. So there's a certain window to launch one of these balloons where it's always over Antarctica, and if it needs to come down, it doesn't land in water. So there's a facility just outside of McMurdo that launches these balloons. The balloons are massive. They're filled with millions of square feet of or cubic feet, I should say, of helium. And they carry up on the magnitude of like 8,000 pound science experiments, and they can stay up there for over a month. Sometimes they have malfunctions, or they're only designed to be up for 24 days or whatever. So that's pretty cool. And sometimes you can see them launch from the station. The South Pole has some super fascinating science as well. A lot of it looking at space stuff, and like the beginning of the universe stuff. There's a giant telescope. I forget what it is. It's like a 13 meter dish. So it's pretty big. There's a thing called the Ice Cube Project, which looks at neutrinos. And that is a system of, I forget how many boreholes, but essentially they've buried this huge set of sensors close to 2 kilometers below the surface of the ice in this super hard, super clear, dense ice. And they have this system of, they call it a string of pearls, but they're essentially these fancy cameras on these, in these big glass spheres arrayed along a tendril or whatever.
And they're designed in such a way that when a neutrino crosses through the array, it has to hit at least two of them, and so they can see which direction it was traveling and how fast. And so what does it look like from the surface? Nothing. You know, it's just like just a bunch of snow. Just a bunch of snow and ice. With a building in the middle of it. And this building is pretty cool. It looks like this like alien landing ship. It has these two big wings that stick off that go into the ice. And if you get a tour of this building, there's essentially the most cables I have ever seen coming out of the ground. But these two, the two wings that sort of plug into the building are filled with all these, whatever they, you know, like Cat 5 cables or whatever they are. But it's for thousands of these sensors. And you can watch on like a computer screen as like events are happening and these things are like shooting by and you're like, whoa, like
that's cool.
It's a real time image of a neutrino that came from like the start of the universe. That's pretty crazy. Like I'm just sitting here drinking some hot cocoa. So there's a lot of cool science that is happening, a lot of atmosphere, air quality sampling, stuff like that, to see what kind of pollutants can make it that far. Also, just, I mean, you know, what's happening with the ozone, all that kind of jazz.
Yeah. Very cool. Does it ever get a little, not overwhelming, but the scale of everything, do you get used to the scale of everything? I mean, from the size of the tractors to 80,000 gallons of oil to buildings full of cables, it's just like everything's like a huge.
Everything's huge. So it's like 25,000 gallons of diesel fuel, just to clarify. But it does take a while to get used to the size of things. Because some of the vehicles at McMurdo Station, their tires are 6 feet tall and there's a bunch of them. It's not like, oh, look at that crazy huge, like redneck truck or whatever. It's like, no, like there's a whole fleet of these things with giant tires or giant treads. And everything is like big and heavy and metal and like whatever. It's industrial, essentially. Yeah. You know, I mean, you're at work, but it's industrial stuff. So yeah.
Any big industrial blah blah whatever. It's just you happen to be in maybe the in the coolest place in the world.
Right. Yeah. And like instead of a giant pile of sand, it's a giant pile of snow, you know? Yeah, totally.
Cool. I don't know that I have any more questions.
Yeah, it's all good. I think, yeah, I mean, it's been a bunch of good questions, I think, for sure.
Well, I always kind of figure after however many years I've been doing this, I can ask questions because I know just enough about things to not know what I don't know. So I think I can ask some questions. So hopefully, but it's been great. I really appreciate all the time and have fun.
I try. yeah, totally. And I mean, thanks for reaching out. It was cool for sure.
It is. So, all right. Well, you know, last night I was going to go feed the dog. Tonight I'm going to take her out for a little hike because it's kind of cooled off. So that's always what I got to go do at the end of a podcast is go take the dog out. So.
No wild dog.
Yeah. Awesome. So, well, I appreciate it. And thanks for your time. And I'll make sure this will be out. We'll get it out next week. So you can take it and tell everybody how famous you are.
Totally. They'll be like, I just talked to an astronaut. You'd be like, oh, okay. Astronaut's pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I was on a podcast with tens of listeners.
Well, yeah. Very cool, Randy. I appreciate it. Yeah, just let me know. And we'll be in touch.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Yep.
hit it. Come on, Tay, do some percussion on those keyboards. Come on now. She's my ace of base. I'm her 90s revival. Hack a sidekicks. I'm a human jukebox. I play all the hits. And she's cold, cold as ice. And every single word she says goes in twice. And all the love that we once had, it's gone. And when she hits the dance floor, she turns me on. She's cold as ice. She rips my heart out. She rocks my soul. She rips my heart out. She makes me whole. She breaks my spirit. She blows my mind. She pawns my watches to buy me time. And she's cold. Cold as ice. And every single word she says goes in twice. And all the love that we once had, it's gone. Until she hits the dance floor and turns me on. Oh, she's cold as ice.
Most. And she's coming.